Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Insurance Law Radio. Back on February 26, Hinshaw and our strategic alliance partner, RPC, conducted a seminar in London, England, where we took a look at what's driving claims and exposures in the United States. And in one segment, Simon Laird, who's the head of insurance at RPC, my partner, Pedro Hernandez, and I provided an overview of bad faith law and exposures. Now, this will be apparent to all the U.S. practitioners and insurance professionals, but this is merely an overview, sort of a tickler of some law and strategy in U.S. bad faith litigation. But what's interesting, of course, is the folks on hand who work in London do not have the exposures to bad faith that we have here in the United States, although there's some statutory authority on bad faith exposure. In London, it's largely dormant, and they just don't have, as a practical matter, the concerns that we have in the U.S. regarding bad faith claims and litigation. So we take you now via tape to our seminar in London, England, for this episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. So we're going to segue into our bad faith and extra contractual segment now, and just a few basics. Bad faith and extra contractual liability in the U.S. is a real risk, in some states more than others. It's critical to evaluate claims early on and to do so effectively. You have to be able to identify, because we hear bad faith every day and in so many cases, and most cases are not bad faith cases. You have to be able to separate the serious claims from the what I'll call throwaway claims and make adjustments along the way, because through discovery, sometimes claims and the dynamics of a bad faith claim can change. And it really involves communicating effectively by lawyers with underwriting personnel, claims folks, legal counsel, and brokers, and whoever needs to be involved in the decision-making process, because nobody likes surprises. And you need to get the buy-in of all the folks who need to have buy-in in a case, so that it isn't 2 or 3 years later when the stakes are high, that people are hearing for the first time that a $1 million claim has a $25 to $50 million punitive exposure. We have to always be cognizant of the portfolio interest of the clients that we represent, as well as case-specific issues. And we need to understand how the presence of a bad faith claim can really change the dynamics of litigation. Where you can, it's always beneficial. Identify the bad cases early. You can usually settle them more cheaply. And there's also some benefit in terms of covering your own rear ends with internal management, with reinsurers, and all the other factions you report to, by at least exhausting reasonable opportunities to settle, so you don't get to a point where it's all or nothing, or you, on the eve of a trial, have a multi-million-dollar settlement demand that nobody expected. You want to show, where appropriate, you've made reasonable efforts along the way. But sometimes you just have to suck it up and muster the strength necessary to say, we've got to fight this one, we've got a battle on our hands, let's do the best that we can do. Now, Pedro has the inevitable task of taking 15 or 20 minutes and telling you everything you need to know about the law of bad faith liability in the U.S.
If that's the case, we'll be here for months. But Scott's right. Bad faith, obviously, no one wants to deal with bad faith. It's an expensive thing, especially in the U.S. And it derives from the state courts, and we have 50 states, and quite frankly, I was telling Simon, we could have, it seems like it could be different, 50 different countries. Every state is completely different. For the most part, we do have majority rulings, and we have some minority rulings, and some of the jurisdictions are alike. However, it really differs from state to state when it comes to bad faith. This is intended to give you a little bit of flavor of bad faith in the U.S. We'd be more than happy to provide you with more information if you need it. But bad faith and extra contractual liability varies considerably from state to state, like I just said. There's a difference, obviously, between first party and third party bad faith. Third party bad faith in the U.S. is failing to act in good faith in connection with settling a third party claimants against policyholders. Some of the concerns dealing with bad faith, with third party bad faith that tends to get carriers in trouble is investigating. Okay, that's a big issue in the U.S. and that's usually where the discovery takes place for the most part, which is let's try to discover whether this claim was investigated properly. What did the carrier do versus what the carrier did not do? As Scott said, some of the plaintiffs' bars, or the plaintiffs' bar in some of the jurisdictions, they have a lot of money. So they tend to put together these libraries of, Liberty likes to do X, and as such, that's just an example, by the way. Liberty likes to do X, and as such, in the next case that we may have with high exposure, we're going to try a bad faith case in doing X just like in the other cases, and hopefully try to get them to settle for a ridiculous amount of money or go all the way to the verdict. They do this with a lot of carriers, depending on the jurisdiction. I'm from Florida, and Florida right now, there's a huge movement by the plaintiffs bar, the policyholders plaintiffs bar, against Great American, for example. For some reason, we're seeing quite a bit of lawsuits, bad faith lawsuits against Great American right now. And like Scott said, you have to muster up and be brave in some of these. We just had a case where the client said, enough is enough. Let's try to fight back. And we did, and it took 3 years. And it was a very expensive battle, but I think we were able to, we were successful in showing the plaintiff's bar that enough is enough. No more bad faith type cases like the one that we were litigating. First party bad faith is the failure and delays in settling claims with policyholders. You see this quite a bit throughout the U.S., particularly where I'm from in Florida. Whenever you have hurricanes, or in California where you have wildfires, sometimes it takes a long time to investigate these types of claims. I had one situation where after Hurricane Irma a couple of years ago went through Florida, I had a client who comes to me and said, we did not investigate this for an entire year. What should we do? My response was, get the checkbook ready. And we had to resolve that claim. And so in bad faith cases in Florida or throughout the U.S., the biggest thing is failure or delays in investigation. That's where a carrier can obviously get in trouble. Institutional bad faith, pattern and practice, that's a game changer for insurance companies. In the discovery process, pattern and practice, and then the institutional bad faith, that's what really costs a lot of money. In some jurisdictions, the only thing you have to discover is that the carrier did the wrong thing more than three times. In Florida, for example, if a court said, carrier, you should not be using that exclusion to deny coverage, let's say, and it's found that the carrier did that more than three times, that's a institutional bad faith. And now you're talking about punitives, and you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. Usually that changes the exposure, that changes how much money the carriers will pay on coverage litigation, on experts, and the discovery process it's once that happens, you have to consider settling, or you have to consider going all the way because the exposure is so large once the institutional bad faith discovery process starts. You obviously also have other contractual causes of action. You have fraud, conspiracy, market conduct, and the list goes on and on. So here are some cases that Scott and I picked. We tried to give you some a bit of a flavor throughout the jurisdictions. For the most part, Illinois sets forth the elements of what has to be proven in order to have a bad faith case. So the O'Neill case sets forth the elements of a bad faith case. The insurer ignored, the court will look at whether the insurer ignored the advice of their claims adjusters. That happens sometimes. The adjuster will write a memo to his or her supervisor saying, we may have a large exposure type case here, or we have a duty to defend, and then the supervisor just decides to ignore that. The court will look at that. The insurer refused to engage in settlement negotiations. That happens sometimes as well. The insurer ignored settlement advice of the insured's defense counsel. As you know, in the liability cases, you will have a defense counsel that usually provides you with a range of possible exposure, will provide you with a range of settlement, and courts have looked at to see if the carriers actually paid attention to that range. For example, if the liability attorney says, okay, insurance company, I think we may be facing here a $2 million exposure. However, a demand came in for $800,000. You should really look into settling this case. Well, the courts in a bad faith case will look at that communication, because in bad faith in the U.S., for the most part, everything is discoverable. So they will look at that, and they will look at the ranges, they will look at the defense counsel's recommendations, and if the carrier actually followed it or just simply ignored it. The insurer kept the insured aware of the third party willingness to settle. So in Florida and in my world, in the construction defect coverage arena, it's a little bit difficult. That particular element's a little bit difficult, because for the most part, construction companies will dissolve, or they will close the door, and sometimes you can't even find the insured. So I recommend to carriers, write letters, UPS them, or overnight them, certify the letter. Just have a record that you try to communicate with the insured to let him or her know, look, this is happening, there's a chance to resolve the case. Just keep that insured informed, even if if the letters are just coming back, just create the record, because it's important. And sometimes, by the way, when we have these cases going to trial, the table is empty. You can't find the insured for the most part. But in the bad faith case, the court always looks to see what did a carrier do to attempt to speak to the insured or make the insured aware of what was happening in the case. Adequate investigation. That's really, in my experience, and I think in Scott's experience, that's really what will get a carrier in trouble. What investigation did you conduct? How did you do it? How often did you do it? How long did you do it for before you made the decision to either not defend or to either not indemnify or settle within policy limits? That is key in every single case I've seen. A substantial prospect of an adverse verdict. An adverse verdict existed. Again, your defense counsel will always keep the companies aware of what size verdict may come in, whether it is within policy limit or excess of the policy limit, and that's something that carriers obviously always have to keep in mind. There was potential for damages that exceeded the policy limits. That's very much key. And this is Illinois, but for the most part, this is the majority rule throughout the U.S. This is a common law failure to settlement. It's a common law in terms of settling bad faith cases.
I was just real quickly, there's not a lot of good things you could say about Illinois, but from the standpoint of bad faith, Illinois is not a bad faith jurisdiction for insurers, because our vexatious delay statute caps the recovery for bad faith damages. You go south to Florida, which is great for a lot of things, but you have higher bad faith risk in Pedro's land.
Yes, absolutely. And also California, and our next slide. And again, these are some of the cases that we've seen. There are a lot more cases, but for the most part, California is a state that carriers tend to stay away from because of the bad faith law and overall just the coverage law. Georgia, it's a little bit better than Florida, but for the most part, also problematic. They do follow the majority rule for the most part. But for example, the United States, the United Services Auto Association versus Carroll, it stood for the proposition that bad faith was found where the insurer did not have reasonable grounds to deny the claim that was not completely investigated, where insurer stubbornly this isn't a decision, continue to decline pay without investigation, even after the commencement of litigation. This happens quite often as well in the bad faith litigation, in the coverage litigation, I should say. Sometimes a carrier will deny a claim and will go into litigation, whether the carrier files a deck action. By the way, in my experience in Florida, it's a little bit different from Scott. My clients in Florida, they like to file declaratory relief actions or deck actions because in the construction defect coverage world, that sometimes, how can I say this, helps settle cases. There is a Supreme Court case in Florida, it's called a State Farm versus Higgins, which gives carriers the opportunity to file a deck action at the same time as the liability action. And its reasoning is that it promotes settlement. So once you file a deck action in Florida and you ask the court to determine whether a particular loss is covered or not, all of a sudden the liability action, those lawyers will understand whether there is coverage or not. So those cases tend to resolve cases fairly quickly. So my clients in Florida, they like to file deck actions so that the courts can let us know, okay, there is coverage, there is $1 million, or there is no coverage, and all of a sudden you have a case that you thought would cost $1 million will resolve for $75,000 or $100,000. A cost of defense type of analysis is done. In Florida, we have this statute, which I think is a pretty good one. It's called the Civil Remedy Notice. And this is the last chance a carrier has to cure or fix the wrongdoing that it's alleged to have done. So you have 60 days. Basically, a policyholder will send a carrier a letter and file a letter with the Department of Financial Services in Florida stating what the wrongdoing was, or what the violation was. You didn't settle within policy limits, or you did not investigate appropriately. Well, the carrier then gets 60 days to try to resolve and cure that. If you pay, then there is no bad faith action, okay? In Florida, the civil remedy notice is a condition precedent to bringing in bad faith action. And if you're a carrier writing in the state of Florida, you have to respond to a civil remedy notice. Otherwise, there is a rebuttable presumption that all the things that are alleged by the policyholders are true. And I tell you, some of the things they say, it's really bad stuff in those notices. But you have to always respond. I believe no one reads those things, quite frankly, but you just have to respond some way, somehow, or cure, obviously. If there was a mistake done after an investigation, you absolutely should cure, so this way there's no bad faith action filed against you. So here are some of the statutes throughout the U.S. We've only given you a few. You have Illinois, California. We have the Georgia ones. And in the U.S., we have common law bad faith. We have also, obviously, statutory bad faith. And these are some of the statutes that we have. The last one is from my state in Florida. It's detailed and it's a bit unique, but it has been upheld by the Florida Supreme Court. The case is called Laferrette. It's a 1996 case, and it sets forth all of these elements. And as you can see, these elements are quite severe. You have to show willful, wanton, and malicious, and reckless disregard for the rights of any insured. And if you are found to be in bad faith in Florida under this particular statute, the punitive damages aspect of this is quite large. In Florida, we have something that it's called, well, for the most part throughout the U.S., you want to bifurcate bad faith from coverage actions. Now, some jurisdictions will allow you to bring, which I just find it to be crazy, but to bring a bad faith action along with a coverage action. In Florida, you can't do that. You have to bring a coverage action first. You have to be found they have to find coverage under the policy first. And obviously, then the bad faith action will commence. In Florida, we have something called trifurcation. That means first you bring the coverage action, actually you bring the bad faith action, then there's a pattern and practice action or an institutional bad faith action, and then ultimately there's a punitive damages type trial. Some courts will bifurcate the issue, and you'll try the bad faith action the pattern and practice action along with the punitive damages action, because you don't want the jury just to say, okay, well, all right, there is bad faith, $50 million. Usually they want you to have different set trials with different jurors or different juries to interpret the punitive aspect of it. But in some jurisdictions, you are allowed to bring coverage and a bad faith action at the same time, which obviously creates a more of an exposure and more expensive litigation all around. So again, we can actually be here for quite some time to talking about bad faith, but this is again more of to give you a flavor of bad faith throughout the U.S. But for the most part, this is what you see in the bad faith actions, or what you don't want to see, I should say. Violations of the duty to defend. Usually, particularly in Florida, for example, the courts always look to see, all right, did the insured have to defend itself? That the insured have to spend money defending itself because of a bad decision not to defend. That's usually where it starts off. And if that's the case, and there is a lack of investigation, that's usually where carriers obviously get in trouble. Another one is the duty to settle. That's a big one throughout the U.S., which is you had a chance to settle within policy limit, you did not do so, and then an excess judgment comes in, and now your poor insured is facing multi-million dollar verdict because you did not settle this within policy limit when you had the chance. These are the cases. There's a plethora of cases throughout the U.S., but usually that's the scenario that you see in bad faith cases. Excess verdicts when you had a chance to settle within policy limit and you did not. And then if you couple that with a lack of investigation or just a bad investigation, that's usually when you get the real big bad cases that you don't want to see. And that was my last slide, which is the duty to investigate. So denying claims without considering known or readily ascertainable facts. Some of these elements sound like common sense, but as you all know, sometimes insurance companies do get busy, or you're dealing with catastrophic type events like, you know, in California with fires or in Florida with hurricanes, or if you have earthquakes, you have quite a bit of claimants, and sometimes the investigations are not as good as they should be. But for the most part, there are statutes or there are ways to cure, you know, the wrongdoing or the lack of investigation. Otherwise, you see a bad faith action.
Pedro, you were right when you said there's a lot of times insurers will file actions. My reference was a situation where you're getting into a forum fight and trying to choose a forum and preempt a plaintiff's policyholder's choice of forum. But your circumstances, but also when you're dealing with just the duty to defend, as an insurer, you typically have the choice of defending without reservation, defending under a reservation of rights, or defending under a reservation or denying and filing a DJ. And in a lot of states, you have to file a DJ if you're not going to defend in order to prevent adverse consequences such as estoppel. So Illinois, Wisconsin, probably the majority will. If duty to defend is something that's of interest to you, we have a 50-state survey that goes state by state and covers the law on duty to defend. In terms of bad faith, you know, in the Bible, I guess it's a different golden rule, but in bad faith, it's try no bad faith claim before it's time, because the hope is you never have to try or litigate bad faith. And you really have to, whether it's bifurcation or trifurcation, many states allow you to bifurcate and defer the bad faith case until the issue of coverage is resolved, because in most states, if the carrier wins on coverage, then there cannot be any bad faith liability. But we'll talk about that and some exceptions to that in a moment. But you really have to, in assessing the case, you have to know the capabilities of the policyholder counsel. Some are real threats, others are just, you know, are not in position to seriously pursue a bad faith case. And generally, of course, the motivation is what motivates plaintiffs throughout the world, money. But, you know, sometimes it's to get settlement leverage, it's to broaden the scope of discovery, which would help on coverage. It may be an attempt to abrogate privileges, such as an attorney-client privilege, because in some states, in some circumstances, bad faith claims give a plaintiff more arguments of why something is not privileged. But sometimes you have the holy rollers who are genuinely offended by the conduct and seek to punish or change the conduct, and that can make settling very difficult. And motion practice is also key, because if you establish for whatever reason an application of an exclusion, of the policyholder's failure as a matter of law to establish coverage, and you get rid of the coverage claim, a lot of times the bad faith claim will bite the dust. So Pedro and I have to first and foremost be lawyers, and we have to know coverage, and we have to know trials, but we also have to be historians and educators. And to some extent, all lawyers have to do that when you're in the trial setting, but you really have to learn the negative facts and what could be out there as soon as possible, because knowledge is a way to get behind and find strategies to deal with the bad facts, and not being in position of being caught unaware by documents or witnesses that are going to testify in ways you don't anticipate. And it's also about developing positive facts. And I think here's where some lawyers are weak. There usually are a bunch of, even we always as lawyers tend to focus on the negative or hone in on the dangerous thing. Yeah. But you have to be able to put it in context for the jury in terms of what a claims handler is going through, what he or she is confronted with. You have to be able to humanize the company. You don't talk about the insurer or Aetna or this company or that company when you're before a jury. You talk about the ladies and gentlemen at Chubb Insurance Company. You do everything you can to humanize the company and put the jurors in the shoes of the claims examiner or the underwriter or whoever's conduct is being subject to question. Because policyholders' counsel are masters of distortion and misportrayal. I mean, they will take documents or what they say are facts and really transform them into something much greater or different than what they actually are. So we have to take the Hippocratic Oath as lawyers and, you know, first and foremost, do no harm in what we're doing in representing a company and what we're doing in communicating with the policyholder's lawyer. There's a prospect that that's going to be evidence in the case. So you want to do no harm. You want to be able to, and by the way, sometimes the back and forth correspondence is necessary to make the record and to establish the reasonableness of the conduct, because the conduct may at issue may be going forward post the assertion of the claim or the denial of a claim or the beginning or end of litigation. And you know, there are some situations where policyholders, lawyers just want to run up the cost and everything is, you know, letters, and you sort of just decide for strategic reasons and to, you know, save your client the enormous cost of letter writing campaigns, you just, you know, toss back a volley saying, you know, we dispute your letter or we don't agree to everything or whatever it is. But sometimes you have to be very specific in what you're denying or very specific in facts and laying the foundation for your defense in cases. You know, we want to limit discovery typically, but there's also a lot of affirmative discovery that once you get into the battles of a bad faith action, you need to conduct, and it can help you in retaining the right experts. And obviously, it is all about communications. We need to communicate effectively with opposing counsel, with judges, and most importantly, when you get before a jury, in a way that the jurors can relate to, because unlike us, jurors are not coverage geeks. They approach things from an entirely different perspective than claims professionals, underwriters, or attorneys would do. But as much as we have to master history, history is not the sole determinant of our destiny. And as I talked about earlier, a lot of post-litigation communications and actions become relevant. You could hurt yourself or help yourself by how you do that. And by the way, insurers have a right, a constitutional right in the U.S. to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. So there are restrictions, the White versus Williams doctrine in California, for example, that limits the ability of a policyholder to introduce some things into evidence. But, you know, typically, remember, you write a reservation rights letter, and you're typically focused on not waiving any coverage defense. And claims professionals and counsel are very good at that. But you have to use some measure of discretion, because that cover the waterfront reservation letter that you send that has 55 reasons why there's no coverage, 40 of which don't even apply to the claim,
right,
may come before a judge in motion practice and may come before a jury, and really plays into the notion that the jury's going to hear from the policyholder's lawyer that this is just denial insurance company. They're going to deny based on any grounds, real or imagined. So you have to consider the impact of your communications at trial. Underwriting materials, claim files, reserves, reinsurance, personnel files, other claim files, claim guidelines, underwriting guidelines, pattern and practices are among the sort of standard categories of document requests and subjects of depositions from the policyholders and bad faith claim. So it's always has to be about messaging, and it also sometimes is being careful just not to take the bait, both in handling a claim and trying a bad faith claim. But you know what? And Pedro touched on this earlier. We're not always right. You guys make mistakes from time to time. Lawyers make mistakes from time to time. And circumstances change. So what might have been a proper denial at the time, facts have been learned or the law has changed. Sometimes you stay the course. But sometimes the right thing to do and the best thing to do is to change course, withdrawing a reservation of rights letter, assuming a defense even belatedly, reimbursing a policyholder for some of the defense costs that were incurred before you assume the defense, taking the policyholder out of harm's way by settling the underlying claim. These are just examples of things that you might do. It may be different from your initial coverage position, but subsequent developments and jurors can forgive a mistake, particularly when it's corrected. And when you're dealing with, you know, the state of mind elements for a bad faith, because being wrong doesn't transform into automatic bad faith usually. We'll talk about that in just a second. So steps that you take along the way. Now, you know, considerations, we're always going to say retain competent, experienced counsel to defend the policyholder and to defend you as an insurer, and make sure that you are communicating, getting communications, because you mentioned defense counsel generally is good at telling you about settlement demands and what's wrong with the case. Sometimes, in some states, an insurer can consider coverage issues. Many times in many states, in determining whether or not to settle a claim, an insurer cannot consider coverage issues and must consider just the probability of liability and the likely damages. So you have to know the standard in the jurisdiction that you're dealing with. You can take a look at verdict reporters, which are, you know, available throughout the United States and jurisdictions, what different types of injuries have produced what numbers in terms of jury verdicts. One of the other things you have to do, and you also touched on this, is making proper disclosures to the policyholder, keeping them advised of important developments in the case, knowing when you have to communicate with them directly or ensure that they're involved in the communications, in addition to communicating with defense counsel, informing the policyholder of pertinent facts, such as the existence of a settlement demand, such as what the insurer's decision regarding that demand is, and the insurer's willingness to fund a settlement demand, the potential for an excess verdict, where there is a potential, in other words, where the amount of coverage is not enough relative to what the jury may determine, the potential to award damages that are not covered. So there may be mixed claims where some claims are covered, some claims are not, letting the policyholder know that there, you know, what claims are not covered for which there will not be reimbursement. The ability to apportion covered and non-covered damages through special jury interrogatories, advising the policyholder that it has the right to contribute to a settlement or to obtain personal counsel to advise it. And that's, of course, far different from pressuring policyholder to contribute to a settlement, which generally, or sometimes anyway, could be itself an act of bad faith. So in the right world, if this was a true just place, If you were right on coverage as an insurer, you should never be subject to bad faith, right? Because if you were correct in denying coverage, well, how could there be bad faith? In most jurisdictions and in most cases, that is the law. If you win on coverage, you're golden on bad faith. That's not always the case, and it's becoming the case less and less as time goes on. You had mentioned failure to investigate is commonly a way that even if you're right, if you didn't take the right steps to investigate, if you weren't reasonable in responding to a claim, you could be held liable for bad faith. It's what I call, you know, in criminal cases, you hear about the process crimes, like perhaps somebody didn't get information from Russia, but they lied to the prosecutors, or they lied to Congress, or they lied to a grand jury. The process crime notion in criminal law in the U.S. is sometimes at play in coverage law, which is you made the right coverage decision, but you didn't dot all the I's. You didn't comply with governing state insurance regulations. You didn't do the right investigation can get you in trouble. Well, the notion that if you're right on coverage, you should be absolved from bad faith is in slide 37. I'm having to whip through some of these things to spare you people. I mean, you would die of boredom if we went through everything here, but it's articulated differently in different jurisdictions. Sometimes the standard is a fairly debatable standard. If there's a fair debate as to whether something is or isn't covered, even if the insurer comes down on ultimately what's the wrong side, if it's fairly debatable, it's not bad faith. Sometimes it's a standard articulated as reasonableness. If the insurer acted reasonably or took a reasonable position, even if it turns out to be wrong, it's not bad faith. And then there's the genuine dispute doctrine that I love, because for a period of about 18 months in my office, I was known as the $11 million man. Now, you guys probably, did you get the TV show, The $10 Million Man here? Lee Majors, back in the 70s, was married to Farrah Fawcett, and he had that show. Well, I was the $11 million man because I was subject to a $10 million and $1 million attorney's fees award in a case in California. So it wasn't really a term of affection. They were making fun of me. But ultimately, I was worth zero because we got it zeroed out. But it was because of the genuine dispute doctrine. During the life of the case, the California courts changed, and the law evolved in California about interpretation. In that case, it was a pollution exclusion. And the Court of Appeals said, well, what the company did was, you know, whether it's right or wrong, it was always reasonable. It was a genuine dispute. Therefore, there's no bad faith. But generally, that case also stands for the proposition that, look, you can always find two judges that disagree on something, right, whether it's in the same state or it's different states. If insurers are required to always play to the lowest common denominator, in other words, anytime some uninformed judge or some judge with a case that's similar but yet not on all fours determines rules against you, and you have to make a coverage determination based on that ruling, it would be the insurers always lose. And it'd be a standard, really, that would be unsustainable. Insurers do have the right to advance their reasonable interpretations of policy language and of coverage. They just have to do so reasonably. And the Griffin case I was referring to stands for that proposition. There's so much more that we could talk about bad faith, but let's, for now, just sort of leave it at that. I want to spend a couple minutes, though, since we have, you know, obviously having cogent claim handling procedures, following regulatory requirements in the state are all essential. The final point I'll make on bad faith, and it applies to everything, you are the kings if you're a claims handler of your claim file, or if you're an underwriter of your underwriting file. There are more bad faith actions are fueled by extraneous content in those files, whether it's statements about individuals or it's loose statements in this Me Too politically correct age in particular. You have to be careful about what's in your files to make sure you're documenting what you're doing, and also what's not in your files, which is anything that, you know, a jury could look at and say, boy, there's some improper motivation going on here. And if, and by the way, sometimes it's not even anything that you would look at the first time and say, oh boy, this Kerry really doesn't like this plaintiff, or has a prejudice or has a bias on something. But it's something that you say that's maybe not artful, that these plaintiff's lawyers can twist around or combine with some other subsequently happening evidence. So always, you know, read your claim notes, your underwriting notes a second time with sort of that objective view of what's right or wrong. So you don't, let's say you've committed bad faith, that usually does not translate into punitive damages. There's got to be more. There has to be a culpable state of mind, that you've acted willfully, wantonly, that you've acted in gross disregard for the rights of the policyholder in order to get punitive damages assessed against you. So it's got to be more than just being wrong. Usually it's got to be more than just being incorrect. There's got to be some malice, some despicable conduct, some oppression, some fraud, some misrepresentation, which is one thing that's not necessarily always an intentional misrepresentation, or it's not something that necessarily is blatant but then turns out to be something that can be construed as a misrepresentation. And a lot of states have statutory limits. Pedro alluded to Flores, but I had the privilege as a very young lawyer, before I started to have to use Touch of Gray, of being involved in a lot of U.S. Supreme Court briefing on punitive damages and the constitutional standards. And in the U.S., there's a very defined body of law. We have a bunch of the cases there. We're not going to go through them, but again, if you want the presentation, let us know. But essentially, what we've come down to are limits on punitive damages that require sort of a three-pillar showing that considers reprehensibility and other factors that you could look at. The one thing I would say is I am really surprised, and not in a good way, at there are a lot of things you should do and need to do when you are defending a case involving punitive damages that starts with asserting the right defenses in the answer to the complaint. Establishing some of the constitutional principles. It's taking steps along the way to preserve the record.
Right.
A lot of details with that. The one final thing before we get into emerging and hot claims I want to mention, it's something to be of interest to a lot of you, is a trend in the U.S. where policyholders are seeking to hold claims examiners and adjusters personally liable for breaches of statutory duties and for bad faith. There's some cases out there, but, you know, so a poor person earning, you know, what is a typical claims person in the U.K.? It's not enough for the work that you do in the first place, but it's certainly not enough to be exposed to tens or hundreds of millions of pounds, ever work as a claims adjuster.
That was incredibly interesting. I learned a lot, including to drop in three quarters of the way through a presentation that your audience might be personally liable. Is a good way to make sure everyone's listening. The whole social inflation or claims trend thing is an incredibly interesting area. Some of it impacts globally. Some of what Scott was talking about is not just contained to the US. But I think when you start looking at juries and the impact of juries, which is fascinating, it has a bigger impact in the US, and I think that's why we're seeing social inflation being talked about in the US. But certainly these social trends are impacting, if you look at litigation funding, mass claims which are being brought, more sophisticated claims management companies, regulators who are more consumer friendly, policy wordings which are from soft market conditions. All of these things contribute, whichever jurisdiction you're in, to some of what we're seeing on social inflation. Thank you very much, all of you, for your time. There is coffee on that afterwards, so if people have questions they want to ask afterwards, please do hang around. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.